is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Okpo, and here's what's coming up.
There is clearly a crisis of malnutrition. No rain since more than 3 years, and where people have really difficulties now to gather enough food to face actually the period of dry season.
That was Berengere Guise, the Médecins Sans Frontières official responsible for emergency services, on a growing hunger issue plaguing southern Madagascar due to an Islamic insurgency. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Aid organizations call the hunger situation in southern Madagascar dire and in need of urgent world attention. Perennial drought in that part of the country has led to a disappearance of food, leaving over a million people starving and thousands of children malnourished. With the return of adequate rain still uncertain, an estimated $75 million is required to assist the hungry till the end of the year. From Johannesburg, Tuso Kumalo speaks to representative of aid organizations in Madagascar.
For many families across the globe, choosing what, where and when to eat are luxurious choices for families. However, for those in the southern part of Madagascar, the situation is completely different. Aid organizations say up to 1.3 million people in that area face severe food shortages, with the worst drought in 40 years. The United Nations says sandstorms and pest infestations have worsened the situation, wiping away 60% of crops. Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, also known as Doctors Without Borders, has been on the ground in Madagascar since the beginning of the year. Beonja Gure is the MSF official responsible for emergency services and is in charge of Madagascar.
The situation is clearly quite dire. There is clearly a crisis of malnutrition. No rain since more than 3 years, and where people had really difficulties now to gather enough food to face actually the period of dry season. So we observe a lot of acute malnourished children that require emergency care. Huh?
Kenneth Bowen, country director for Dodge Waltonge Haifa, says this has pushed citizens to resort to desperate measures to survive.
There have been pretty dire coping mechanisms, including the sale of household assets to try to gain sufficient money to buy food, and foraging in the local countryside to try to for wild foods and roots to eat. So the situation is extremely serious. 500,000 children who are acutely malnourished. Of that figure, over 100,000 children are severely malnourished.
Gwe says organizations like MSF are doing their best, but it's clearly not enough.
We combine nutritional activities with food distribution as well. So we focus mainly on children under 10 years old. And we as well combine this intervention with all the treatment of the associated disease to those children. So we distribute as well a complete food ration for the entire family who had malnourished children.
And Bowen has this passionate call to the international community.
More is required in terms of funding from major institutional donors around the world. At the moment, we're saving lives by providing unconditional cash transfers and food assistance to households. But over and above that, there still needs to be a lot of support in terms of food and nutrition security, in terms of education, health, social protection, livelihood support for those same people.
In his recent address to the UN General Assembly, Malagasy President Andry Nirina Rajoelina described the situation as a wave of drought that has left water sources dry, rendering all forms of subsistence activities impossible. The effects on families have been devastating. Locusts, wild leaves, raw red cactus fruits and roots constitute a decent meal for many. But many others are too weak and sick to gather these in the bushes. The World Food Programme says families are already dying from severe hunger. If nothing is done fast, up to 28,000 people are expected to be in a catastrophic condition soon. those who have sold everything to fill their bellies now wait for one or two things: death or assistance. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is meeting today with President Joe Biden at the White House, where the conflict in northern Ethiopia is expected to head a wide-ranging agenda. It's Biden's first meeting at the White House with an African leader. Kenya holds the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council this month. The United States and Kenya have long cooperated on economic and security initiatives, including counterterrorism. The White House is considering sanctions against parties to the conflict in the Badag-Tigray region. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki said in a statement that the two leaders also will discuss, quote, efforts to defend democracy and human rights, advance peace and security, accelerate economic growth, and tackle climate change, unquote. Kenyan Olympic runner and two-time World Championship bronze medalist Agnes Tirop, a rising star runner in Kenya, has been found dead at her home with stab wounds. Police say her husband is missing and is wanted for questioning. His family reported he called them crying and asking for God's forgiveness for something he had done. Tirop won bronze medals in the women's 10,000 meters at the 2007 and 2019 World Championship and finished fourth in the 5,000 meters at the Tokyo Olympics. She also broke the world record in the women's only 10-kilometer road race in Germany last month. Medical aid groups are welcoming plans by U.S. drug maker Moderna to build a plant for manufacturing vaccines in Africa. The group says the plant, the first from a company making a COVID-19 vaccine, will help in fighting vaccine inequality. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
African countries are facing a shortfall of nearly 500 million COVID-19 vaccines, according to the World Health Organization. The shortage has left most countries unable to vaccinate even the most vulnerable 10% of their populations. Last week, U.S. drug maker Moderna announced plans to build a plant on the African continent. Its statement is raising hope Africa will have a sufficient supply of COVID-19 vaccines in the future. Medical aid groups say although the plan will boost Africa's vaccine manufacturing capacity, the continent still needs an immediate solution to the shortages. Dr. Githinji Gitahi is the chief executive officer at AMREF Health Africa.
As significant as it is, especially because of the high financial commitment of $500 million, there are several factors to consider. One, that this factory will not be a solution to the current challenge of vaccine access in Africa. If the factory is going to be ready 2 to 4 years, Africa wants to vaccinate at least 70% of its people by June next year. And therefore, Africa still demands that actually the most important step is redistribution of doses that are earmarked for rich countries to come into Africa.
Although Moderna has yet to say where it will build the factory, at least 10 countries, among them Kenya, Morocco, South Africa, and Senegal, have expressed an interest in hosting the facility. Dr. Willis Akhwale, the chairman of Kenya's vaccination task force, says Moderna will need to look at the project as a partnership with the host country.
I think that, to me, is first and foremost. And the other thing is the capacity building of the local people beyond just the COVID-19 vaccines towards the whole human vaccine manufacturing.
The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention welcomes the idea of manufacturing the COVID-19 vaccine on the continent. Dr. Bahanads Ogutu, chief executive officer at the center's office in Kenya, says although the process is likely to take a long time, it's a promising sign for making healthcare more available in Africa.
If we really want to make healthcare affordable and accessible to all, then we must start doing a lot of production of health commodities within the region.
By September, an estimated 5.2 billion COVID vaccine doses had been administered globally, but only 2% of those were in Africa. African medical groups say they hope that the manufacturing of such vaccines on the continent will prevent such unequal distribution in the future. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
A report marking the International Day for Disaster Risk Reduction finds many deaths and economic losses from natural disasters could be averted by investing in preventive disaster risk reduction measures. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Climate-related disasters have nearly doubled over the past 20 years, with developing countries bearing the brunt of the disasters. Though extreme weather events and other disasters continue to grow, the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction says little money is being allocated to help countries prevent or reduce risks. The report finds $133 billion of official development assistance was allocated for disaster-related aid between 2010 and 2019. But only $5.5 billion was invested in measures to reduce the risks and lessen the impact of disasters. For every $100 spent on disaster-related development aid, it says only 50 cents go toward protecting development from the impact of disasters. Office for Disaster Risk Reduction Director Ricardo Mena says even that low-level ODA funding should be better targeted. He says it should be used to address the many needs of poorer, more vulnerable countries.
One would think that countries that are more prone to disasters and that experience higher mortality rates would be the ones where DRR financing would be allocated the most. But insufficient investment is being provided to prevent future disasters in areas where high mortality is likely.
Mena says failure to invest in DRR or disaster risk reduction is like buying a nice car which has no brakes.
Investing in DRR, we know it makes sense, and in terms of cost benefit, it's tremendously positive. So yes, we are saying it's better to attack the underlying factors of risk than having to spend more money at a time when disasters actually happen.
Academic studies find every dollar invested in disaster risk reduction prevention can result in savings of $3 to $15 in disaster losses. MENA is calling for an increase in ODA funding to help poor countries adapt to climate change and implement national strategies for disaster risk reduction. He cites small island states, the least developed countries, and landlocked developing countries as particularly needy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Uganda has started on the process of voluntarily repatriating over 2,000 Burundi refugees. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Some of the refugees have stayed in Uganda's refugee settlements for over 6 years. In a bid to facilitate their safe return, the Uganda government are cooperating with refugee agency UNHCR to repatriate them in batches. A group of over 300 has been okayed to start their journey to Burundi. Irene Abina is a refugee desk officer in southwestern Uganda. She said the refugees willingly decided to return to Burundi without any coercion.
First of all, the supported voluntary repatriation is a big issue in that it has even the involvement of the country of origin. Of course, their countries of origin have to make the environment, of course, conducive. First of all, for people to show willingness and to believe and trust in their country. We have been able to sensitize them on durable solutions that helps to end the cycle of refugees.
Godfrey Biaruhanga is a senior field coordinator in the Department of Refugees. He told VOA that COVID-19 travel restrictions postponed the repatriation, which was scheduled to start last year.
And because of COVID-19, borders were closed, but the pressure was too much from Burundians who wanted to go back home. And comparing it with what is happening now, of course, when the COVID-19 restrictions were relaxed, we engaged the Republic of Tanzania so that we can use their territory on road to take people back home to Burundi.
Esther Davinia Anyakun is Uganda's Minister of State for Relief, Disaster Preparedness and Refugees. Speaking to the media at Nachivale Settlement, Anyakun asked the Burundian government to support the returnees in practicing the vocational skills they have acquired from Uganda.
For example, if they can regroup them and also be able to give them more support in terms of startup capital to be able to do the skills, because they have learned how to do fabrication, they have learned how to do things like knitting, they have learned things like bricklaying and so many other things. So it would be very good for them to have a continuous support just like when they get there, something to be able to they generate income out of the skills they have learned from their stay in Uganda when they were refugees here.
Statistics from UNHCR indicate Uganda is currently home to about 51,000 Burundian refugees. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Medics in eastern Congo began an Ebola vaccination campaign on Wednesday, the World Health Organization said, days after the death of a two-year-old boy and confirmation of a second case raised fears of another outbreak. The toddler died last Wednesday in a clinic in Beni, one of the epicenters of a 2018-2020 outbreak which killed more than 2,200 people and infected about 1,000 more. The WHO said three people from the same neighborhood died in September after experiencing Ebola-like symptoms, which include severe vomiting and diarrhea. Health officials said it isn't clear yet whether the latest cases are linked to previous outbreaks. Starting in December, Nigeria will require civil servants to show proof of vaccination for COVID-19 or a negative test for the disease to gain access to their offices. A presidential committee said yesterday the unvaccinated government workers will need to present a negative test result done within 72 hours before they are granted access to their offices across the country and its embassies abroad. A South African university has opened a Center of Excellence for Surgical Skills, a first of its kind on the continent. Wits University in Johannesburg, recognized internationally as having one of the best medical schools in the Southern Hemisphere, says the center aims to improve the quality of surgery first in South Africa, then across Africa. Darren Taylor reports.
Wits University's new Surgical Skills Laboratory, established at a cost of almost $2 million, will train surgeons using state-of-the-art equipment and some of the world's foremost medical experts.
The unmet need for surgical care across South Africa and particularly low-income countries is a significant humanitarian crisis.
Professor Martin Smith's head of the university's Department of Surgery. He says there's a critical shortage of medical specialists in Africa, even in the continent's more developed regions.
While South Africa has better access to surgical care compared to other sub-Saharan countries and low-income countries, the problem is that we don't always have the highest quality of surgical care. And so to improve that quality of surgical care, we need to strengthen our district and our regional hospitals. And to do that, amongst other things, we need to strengthen the human resources.
Smith will be in charge of the new lab.
What this offers us an opportunity to do is to really impact on the quality of the human resources that are needed to provide that kind of surgical care. So this skills lab offers us an opportunity to do significant training in a standardized and in a managed way using modern technology to ensure that the training of the next generation of surgeons will be appropriate for the work that they expected to do.
He explains that the Surgical Skills Lab will employ the services of leading surgeons from multiple fields of medicine.
So disciplines of orthopedics, neurosurgery, ear, nose and throat surgery will all have an opportunity to join in this endeavor and to contribute and to ensure that their trainees take full advantage of this. It's a very versatile environment, and so we can use it for in a number of different ways. We're also able to train undergraduate students, graduating doctors, in also basic surgical skills.
Smith says South Africans will benefit from the Center of Excellence first.
This unit doesn't actually provide an opportunity to operate on patients. This prepares people to operate on patients on the historical platform in which we provide service. The university doesn't work in isolation. We work together with the national and provincial departments of health. And so we do our actual training and our service delivery and some of our research on the public hospital and some private hospital platform.
But eventually, says the surgeon, it's hoped that doctors from across Africa will sharpen their skills at the lab to promote proper surgical care all over the continent.
Globally, it's recognized that of the 7 billion people on this planet, 5 billion do not have access to surgical care or appropriate surgical care. And in addition, we've recognized that about 143 million extra surgical procedures need to be performed yearly to achieve adequate access.
Smith says Wits University's Surgical Skills Lab is a first but extremely important step on a long journey towards achieving this. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
100 days after South Africa was shaken by the worst unrest since the end of apartheid, ransacked businesses say they still haven't received government support to get back on their feet. With a local election looming, frustrations over the slow cleanup is putting the future of the ruling African National Party Congress to the test. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
Business owners at a Soweto strip mall watched helplessly as looters destroyed their livelihoods during nationwide political unrest in July. 3 months later, the building remains a shell of what it was. While South Africa's government promised $93.3 million, or 1.4 billion rand, to rebuild, business owners in Soweto say they haven't seen any money or even simple construction approvals to help them recover. Armando Simbini is a tailor in Soweto.
They take everything. I don't have nothing. The politician is a promise, but nothing happened. Promise, I'm going to do it, that one, do it, that one, nothing has happened.
It's not just business owners who are enduring the challenges caused by the riots. At the historic Walter Sisulu Square, where the foundation of the Young Democracy's constitution was laid, government offices remain shuttered. It means area residents are struggling to access their pensions, welfare checks, and services like driver's license renewals. Sifiso Kanyele is a facilities manager at Walter Sisulu Square, a national heritage site.
I feel it's taking long. People are suffering around Cape Town, around El Dorado Park, Pinville. They come and access their services here. They are struggling a lot. So if they can speed up the process of fixing the place, it can be much better for our people.
But some people in the community say they haven't been waiting for just 3 months. They say they've been waiting for social and economic improvements for nearly three decades under the ruling African National Congress. Despite local elections looming, Griselda Jus-Swartz, a community activist, says frustrations won't necessarily be shared at the ballot box.
They don't want to vote at all. They feel it's a waste of time. I think they feel that they have put their trust into a government that hasn't met their needs. They feel forgotten. They feel neglected.
But ANC officials say they have not abandoned the public. Johannesburg's City Council Speaker, Nonkeba Molwele, says the party remains the most experienced and understanding of the people's plight. As for the cleanup, she says the public just needs to be patient.
I visited some of the businesses that were damaged in Soweto in particular, and the leadership of the ANC was there on the ground with the business owners that were affected. So there is a plan and they have already started to assist those businesses.
Whether those reassurances will be enough will be tested when South Africans head to the polls November 1st. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I am Chinua Rofo in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat.
African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.